everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you with the Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing new ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. I love the question about man's basic nature. We've been approaching that recently. And brought to my attention is a new book by Dacher Keltner called Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. Such an interesting question, meaningful life. What is a meaningful life? I remember Man's Search for Meaning. That was such an important book in my life. Let's go on to see what Dacher has to say. Dacher, could you talk about this Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life? How would you describe a meaningful life?
Well, it's great to be here, Armand. So my answer to that question really found inspiration in Eastern philosophy and then this new Darwinian science of positive emotion that helps us, as you say, have more positively oriented minds. And I was studying emotions like compassion and gratitude and reverence and modesty. And these are all emotions that give us great meaning, that are founded on really high levels of meaning and a sense of community. And I was trying to find a word that really captured the spirit of those emotions that are so important to meaning and happiness. And I thankfully was raised by a father who had me read a lot of Eastern philosophy, and I turned to Confucius, and there was this idea of Zen, which really I feel is our best step toward a meaningful life. And Zen is where it's a very simple idea. It's where we revere and respect others, and we bring out the good in other human beings. And I felt that's what I was studying, and that's the art of the meaningful life.
Zen.
Yeah.
All right, and could you go just a little further with it? Now, according to the Eastern philosophies, this is the art of a meaningful life is finding this kind of attitude towards others.
Right. It's about acting in ways that bring out the good in others and that don't bring out the petty or the small-minded or the selfish in others. Of sort of bringing their good character to fruition. And a lot of the emotions and the social practices that I study, things like when we feel inspired by somebody's moral virtue, which we call elevation, or when we laugh and we make light of ourselves, or even when we tease and play, these are emotions that have at their core this very interesting Zen quality of bringing out the good in others, making others more cooperative, and so that's how I look at it.
How do you, how would you give me an example of that? Let's say you were an employer and you were working with an employee who made a mistake. How would you bring out the good in that person instead of, and what's an example of the negative kind of response you would create?
Right. Well, that's a terrific example, Armand. And so, and it actually maps onto a couple of things that we've studied in our lab. So one of the places that got me interested in Jan and bringing out the good in others is, what do we do when we make mistakes? And I started to study an emotion that was little understood at the time, which is embarrassment. And I found, as I did these very careful analyses of the facial display of embarrassment and the blush, that we turn our neck and we show this modesty. And what that response does is it brings out the good in others who observe our mistakes. It's a way of signaling an apology and triggering forgiveness. And then what would happen in the workplace, to carry on with your example, is people who see this kind of healthy embarrassment response are likely to pat the person on the back. They're likely to laugh it off. They're likely to make light of the mistake. And we know, for example, and I talk about this in the book, there's an amazing science of touch that shows that when we just pat each other on the back, we're giving each other boost to the immune system, we're calming cardiovascular stress down, we're giving people little bursts of opioids or oxytocin. So just in that simple example, I think, that you nicely articulated, you've got great evidence of how we're wired to bring out the good in others.
The let's say somebody makes a mistake, or let's say you ask somebody a question and they respond defensively. Now, responding defensively is not turning on the good people, right? I mean, that's not, if you get to somebody and you say, hey, what happened to the letter you were supposed to send out?
Right. Right. And you know, the, you know, defensiveness and adversarialism and counterattack and all of these responses that fit into that family. You know, John Gottman, in his work on marriage, was one of the first to show that that's one of the real toxic behaviors in these emotions countervail, which is a distrust of each other or a sense that the other person is not acting in your best interest. So it is one of the more toxic developments in work and in love.
But in almost every situation, there is this, if a person is going to be defensive because they were caught at something, you know, they did something they weren't supposed to do, or they didn't do something they were supposed to do, and they have a habit of lying, for example. I know many
right.
employees who just lie every time.
Oh,
they get
goodness.
Now, if they do, these are people who you're trying to raise their level.
Right.
But you know they're going to lie to you. You know, you say, did that letter go out? Oh, sure, I sent that letter out last week. Now, if that happens, how would you, as somebody who's working to bring somebody up to a level, how would you get them down? How would you do it?
Right. Well, you know, I think it's a very telling question, Armand, because part of what really struck me about the science of the meaningful life is there are a lot of emotions that bring out the good in each other, right? Compassion and reverence and gratitude, and we can talk about those. But clearly, we can't be too Pollyannish about human nature, and there's a lot of conflict, and there's lying, and there's competition, and there are competing interests. It's the very core of being genetically separate beings, of being a sibling, or being in a romantic relationship, or at work. And what I got really impressed with is how we've evolved certain kinds of emotions that help us deal with the kind of conflict that you're talking about. One is laughter. And so, you know, one thing that really effective people at work and in marriage do and in families is they laugh about these lies and these conflicts, and that creates a safer context for sincere commentary or recommendation. Another one that might strike your listeners as a little counterintuitive, but there are a lot of good studies on this, is teasing. That we use teasing to in workplaces and in sibling dynamics as a way to playfully provoke each other, to say, hey, I have a feeling you didn't send that out, and bringing about more truth. So I'd vote for teasing and laughter.
Teasing, sarcasm.
Well, we really have to, your questions are right, and we have to sort out these nuances of this very delicate behavior and this complex behavior we use to sort of negotiate our conflicts. And I separate teasing, which is more playful, and uses all the art of being foolish and acting like a jester and being goofy and using a funny tone of voice from sarcasm, which is lacking that playfulness and a little bit more mean-spirited.
So is there any way, okay, so let's try a bigger model. Many years ago, Marilyn Ferguson,
who,
do you know who she is? She wrote The Aquarian Conspiracy, and she...
I know the name, I haven't read that.
She worked with a few organizations about trying to up the level of their functioning.
Yeah.
And she basically said, you know, if we're all honest with each other and we all show our loving sides, we're going to be really fair and we're going to do some wonderful stuff. And a couple of organizations followed her model and they did really wonderful stuff. But they found that people are always bringing their baggage to work. And, you know, you bring what you carry with you. You're carrying stuff with you. And it's very hard to respond to work in a way that is different than the way you would respond at home.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard. So if somebody is a damaged child.
Yeah.
And they come to you for employment, right?
Right.
How do you get them to not be a damaged child when you're talking to them. I mean, they're still the same person who's going to respond at the lowest possible level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're putting your finger on something that I think a lot of us can relate to, which is increasingly with these new technologies and how much we're working, there's less of a separation between the workplace and home. And I would argue that is actually, there are many opportunities there. And what we're learning, there's a new science of management and effective leadership and effective workplace dynamics. And it's moving away from just pure strategy and rational recommendations and more toward the emotional, right? And this is Danny Goleman's emotional intelligence. There's just a new paper out that says that, by Stéphane Côté, that managers and workplace, people in the workplace who use the tools and the skills of emotional intelligence, listening, managing your emotions, being playful, joking around, treating each other with respect and the like, actually promote healthier and more productive workplaces, above and beyond any other kind of workplace strategy. So what that tells us, and I really believe this, Armand, that we've evolved these really important cooperative tendencies, be it laughter, respect, listening, compassion, expressing appreciation. And they work as powerfully at home as they do out on the playing field as they do in the workplace. And they're to be cultivated.
We're speaking with Dr. Keltner, K-E-L-T-N-E-R, author of a new book, Born to be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. And, Doc, while we're at it, you talk about a gen ratio. What is the gen ratio?
Yeah. Thanks for asking. So, I've spent 20 years of my scientific life coding facial expressions in the work inspired by Paul Ekman. And, I'm very interested, like a lot of scientists, in what are the most efficient, powerful ways we can measure something. And in this case, I was interested in, how do I know I'm leading the good life, that at the end of life, when I sum things up, I'll feel like I've led a life well lived? And I started to get inspired by this concept of gen, and so I thought about what you might call a gen ratio as a way to very quickly and in a nuanced fashion take stock of where your life is. And what the ratio is in the top part of the ratio or numerator, you put all the actions in the moment that someone is engaging in that brings out the good in other people, right? A compliment, a generous offer, and the like. And then in the denominator, you put all the actions in which somebody is bringing out the bad in others.
I mean, if you're going to do that specifically, do you do it about yourself?
You can do it about anything, and that's why I like this. You can do it about your child at school. You can do it about your marriage. You can look at your neighborhood and tally up the actions. You can look at...
All right, let's do it a little slower. Let's say you're looking at yourself.
Right. So I take stock of the day and I say, hopefully in an unbiased fashion, although that's doubtful, but what have I done that brought out the good in others? And I would think about the compliment I gave to a child and the pat on the back to my daughter's teacher and hopefully a few expressions of gratitude to my family members, and I picked up a piece of trash that makes a lawn prettier for other people to see. Those are high-gen actions, if you will. Then, looking at myself, I would think about, on the bottom of the ratio, the things that I've done recently that made other people more petty or selfish or less cooperative. Things like, maybe I was too short with a student passing by in the hallway, or I used a harsh tone of voice to my child. And I think that kind of ratio where you think about the amount of ways in which you've brought out the good in others, and then you divide it by how you've brought the smaller side to human nature to completion, gives you a sense of, are you living in a way that promotes a stronger community?
Well, yeah, okay. Now, most people I know will look at the negative things that they've done.
Yeah.
And they'll rationalize them.
Yeah.
They'll say, well, I had to tell her that what she was wearing didn't look good on her. And here I am, somebody who loves this person, and I'm going to tell her, I was just telling her the truth.
Yeah. No, no doubt. You know, and there's and you're speaking to a rich literature in social psychology, which shows particularly Westerners are likely to look upon themselves and rationalize in favorable ways, right? Well, I was really cold with that person, but, you know, that person needed some tough love at that moment. And fair enough, that's part of the problem of figuring out how ethically we're behaving.
Maybe,
but what
maybe you could make it easier on us all.
Okay.
If we did it the simple way, a plus mark and a minus mark.
Okay.
All right, forget about whether or not I made that person feel good about themselves. How much did I do today that came from a negative space? And how much did I do today that came from a positive space? So could I put a plus mark on my first communication with the person I saw this morning at my door? Could I put a minus mark when I spoke to that person on the phone who didn't deliver the product?
Yep.
And maybe I can make it simpler if I look at it as pluses and minuses at the beginning.
Yeah.
Then once I'm willing to take stock like that, you know, maybe I could then be a little more honest with myself.
I agree.
And look at the other qualities.
I think that's fair, Armand. But what I like about Jen is it shifts us to think about what are we doing to bring out the good in others, which I think is a mind shift that we need in our culture. But I think we do that, and one of the we do these pluses and minuses, as you're saying, and we do it by turning to these emotions that we've been studying in our lab, which are things like a love of humanity or compassion or gratitude or even just the simple admiration of someone. Those are those pluses that you're talking about inside of us that are the intentions of these more benevolent or cooperative actions.
You know, what's the skinny on the smile? You know, I mean, Angus Trumbull, I remember, did quite a bit of study on it. What's the real thing behind it? Is a smile a gorilla baring its teeth, you know, as we're told by some people?
Yeah.
Or is it something that's fake?
Yeah.
Or what is this smile? What did we find out about the chemistry of the smile and how the smile works?
Well, Armand, the skinny on the smile is really there are many smiles. And Paul Ekman tallies up, you know, 21 different kinds of smiles, I think, in some of his work. The science of the smile, and I can detail for you, has really well characterized 7 or 8 kinds of smiles. So the first big distinction is this, right, which is how do we sort out whether somebody really feels good and warm and kind when they smile from someone who's lying and trying to trick us, right? And the answer, where do you think it lies? What's your guess?
Somewhere in the middle.
Part of the answer will be in the middle, but the real clue to the warm, kind smile is in the eyes. And there is a muscle that surrounds the eyes called the orbicularis oculi. And when it contracts, it raises your cheeks, pouches your lower eyelids. And this is the weird world I live in. I'm very happy if I see a lot of pouched lower eyelids. And then it gives you those dreaded crow's feet. And when that muscle contracts, we know people feel happy, they feel loving, the left side of their frontal lobes lights up, which is associated with pleasure. A young baby, when the mom approaches, that muscle contracts, and when a stranger approaches, that muscle doesn't contract. So that's really the happiness muscle that answers your first big question, which is one kind of smile is warm, kind, cooperative. It involves that muscle movement. And other studies have found it's really quite powerful. If I present a picture of that kind of smile with the crow's feet, with the real contraction of that muscle, people feel trusting. When they see that kind of smile, their cardiovascular physiology calms down. And in primates, it's the first smile that signaled friendliness and cooperation.
So it seems really important that people practice that muscle. I mean, people spend a lot of time doing Kegels, right, trying to strengthen their muscles. You may as well, I mean, the smile muscle looks like it does a lot for you.
Well, it sure does, but it you know, regrettably, happiness isn't that simple, and it's a muscle that 90% of us can't move voluntarily. So the answer to, based on this science for happiness, is not just tweak that muscle, because it's very hard to do, but it's to turn to other things, like being appreciative or spending time with loved ones and the like. So it's hard to do. But then subsequent studies have followed up on that, and you can ask, well, gee, I see a lot of different kind of smiles when I walk around. I see flirtatious smiles and deferential smiles, loving smiles and the like. And we did some research, for example, sorting out sort of a smile of love and devotion versus a more sexual smile. And what you find in a lot of different studies is the sexual smile has little lip licks and lip puckers and tongue protrusions accompanying the smile. And then, amazingly, when good friends are feeling love toward each other or romantic partners, they tilt their head, they show a nice warm smile, and they use these open-handed gestures that non-human primates use to express warmth and affiliation. So
you detail all of this in your book, by the way. Just to remind people, the name of the book is Born to Be Good, The Science of a Meaningful Life. And you kind of show people the different types of smiles that people have. Is there ever a smile that a person should be wary of?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I mean, so, you know, think about it. One of the muscle movements of the smile is the zygomatic major, and it's a muscle in the face that pulls your lip corners up. We see it all the time. People do it all the time. You can keep that muscle movement firing for hours, if not days or weeks or an entire lifetime. And one of the main reasons we use that muscle is to hide all kinds of negative emotions we feel. I remember one time when I first started to learn how to code facial expressions, I came out of the lab. I'd spent hours doing frame-by-frame analyses of these facial expressions, and this woman served me a croissant in a cafe, and she was smiling, but I detected a sneer of contempt underneath the smile, and I knew she didn't think too highly of me. So there are a lot of negative feelings that you can detect underneath the smile.
You could get something out of that. All right. Let's go on to that other issue of yours that I like very much, homo economicus.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, you know, Armand, I was being involved in the study of emotion and altruism and cooperation. I was struck by the cynical view that so many of our thinkers have about human beings. And I summarize this in the idea of homo economicus. And this is a phrase that other scholars have used to describe how we think about human beings. And the basic assumptions of homo economicus are as follows. The first, everything that homo economicus does is selfish, to gratify desire or to propagate our genes. Everything. Even what looks like the most noble, kind action is actually selfishly motivated. Second piece to homo economicus, this hominid is really competitive and always looking to gain competitive advantage. The third idea that has guided our thinking about human nature is homo economicus is really wired to distrust, to be cynical, to find the bad in human beings very quickly over the good. And I talk about this in the book because the sciences that I work in, evolutionary science and trying to understand altruism, have really assumed that we're homo economicus. Everything we do is selfish and competitive and cynical. And in fact, there's a rich new science that is saying, actually, that view of human beings is dead wrong. We are self-interested, of course, but we're remarkably generous. We are remarkably cooperative and trusting. In economic games, if you're given a lump sum of money, you give about half of it to strangers in different parts of the world. And then what I got interested in is the branches of the nervous system that help us give and take care of, that really deviate from this view of homo economicus.
Well, you've got a fairly decent job. You know, if you want to, according to you, if you want to know whether you should date somebody, you should look at their college yearbook. And you can tell how they're going to be 30 years from now. Let's look at that. It was so much fun. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Talk about that, Doctor.
Yeah. Well, I'd never put it in. You're pointing to a whole business opportunity here.
New York way.
So, you know, one of the things that we've learned in the study of human emotion is that amazingly brief episodes of behavior tell us so much about what a person is or the state of a marriage, right? John Gottman can take a few minutes of a conversation in a marriage, and if he sees things like contempt, criticism, defensiveness, which you talked about earlier, Armand, he can predict with 92% reliability that marriage is on its way to divorce. So you're sort of buoyed by that science. One day I got this opportunity, thanks to Ravenna Helson, who's been studying women's lives for 40, 50 years. These women graduated from Mills College in Oakland in the late 50s, 1960. She came to me and said, "Gee, you study facial expression. We have these women's yearbook photos. Do you think that says anything about the life they've led?" And I, you know, was skeptical, but we did the study, and we coded the two muscle movements that we've talked about today to capture the warmth and kindness of the woman's smile. The zygomatic major, pulling the lip corners up, the orbicularis oculi, which, again, produces that pouching of lower eyelid and crow's feet. And what we found were pretty astonishing findings that speak to the truth of what you said about women with warmer smiles at age 20 handle the stresses of life better for the next 30 years. And that's something we've learned about how positive emotions calm us down in the face of life's tribulations and traumas. Women with warmer smiles evoked greater trust in strangers. And then the kicker was that women with warmer smiles, not only did they feel more connected to their community, but they had happier marriages and more meaningful lives 30 years later.
It would make sense that if a person has a warmer smile, in effect, they're warmer people. You know, if you have a tense smile, that means you have a certain amount of comfort with yourself.
Absolutely.
And if that radiates somewhere in your college yearbook,
yeah,
it's probably going to mean that you're going to have an easier life than most folks later on.
Exactly. But I think that it speaks to, in a way, the wisdom of what Charles Darwin was advocating, which is that these very brief muscle movements and ways we hold our bodies and the tone of our voice, like you say, Armand, are really these revealing indicators of our character or of our outlook on life, or in this particular case, is the woman oriented toward connection and kindness.
It's very hard with most of the people whom I've seen in my professional practice. Their lives don't lead to a warm smile.
I know.
You know, so it's like it's very hard when you see it. You know, it's really remarkable. But a lot of people I know have worked through the pains of their earlier childhood to kind of yield this warm smile. It's like where you want to settle at the end.
When
the years go on and you get in front of that fireplace and you're in your later years, you hope that you could have that smile.
I love your frame on that, Armand, that, you know, you want your sum of life as you're sitting in the rocking chair to add up to that warm, nostalgic, reflective smile.
And one that you could share with someone, even if it's your best dog.
Absolutely. And we know a lot of these behaviors we study in our lab, like the smile, talked about the blush earlier, really warm patterns of touch, they're so powerfully contagious. They spread to others in this high-gen way, if you will.
In your studies, do you include relationships with pets?
I don't, but, you know, it's... You know, we're a busy lab, and it's hard enough to figure out how to study relationships, right? But I have a colleague here at Berkeley who is studying the relationship to pets, and one of the really interesting discoveries is, you know, people have particular languages they use to speak to children called motherese, and there's a specific tone of voice we break into when we talk to our pets that has its own acoustic style or its own sound. That is just as warm and loving, and there are a lot of neat new studies speaking to how powerful this mammalian connection is.
This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, a little music, and then we will continue with Dr. Keltner, author of Born to be Good. We'll be right back.
Toza koluka mikolo nyoso se bomoi na ye. Jodia, nous peut prier, on nous partage, moment à la, nous peut aller, plus haut, on nous courage.
This is Armand DeMille back with Dr. Keltner. Dr., let's continue with this a little further, okay? Are you back? Are you still with us?
I'm with you.
Strange music. So why is one theme that emerges in the research reported in different chapters is how meaningful brief emotional expressions are.
Yeah.
Brief. I mean, you're saying even the brief ones that take place in the yearbook, those have meanings.
Yeah.
What is the implication of that in your day-to-day contact with people?
Well, terrific question. You know, just another illustration of how powerful these brief expressions are. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about sorting out different kinds of smiles. And I talked about this more loving head tilt, open-handed loving smile of trust and devotion versus a sexual smile. And we actually did a study where you could code the conversations of couples who are 20 years old, they've been together for a little while, and if you saw this warmer smile, just a few seconds of it, that couple was actually likely to have talked about marriage. Whereas if you saw the more sexual smile, they were very reluctant to have talked about marriage. It pulls apart these emotions of love and sexual desire, but it says, just as you're saying, these very brief expressions tell us so much about where the person is in the moment. And I think the reason why is really the power of emotion. That we, as a very cooperative species, evolving in these social groups of different relationships, needed to evolve some kind of mechanism, if you will, that binds us to each other, that throws us into cooperative relationships or to take care of others in really quick fashion. And the emotions really developed out of that evolutionary pressure, and that's why emotions and how they register in the face and the body are so telling of our loves, our commitments, our distrust, who we revere, who inspires us, because we're emotional beings.
There's a big difference between men and women, the gender differences, between expression and the way that people show themselves.
Oh, my God, you're going to get me in trouble here.
It's so hard not to do it. You know, I know what you're saying. But, gee, the sexes are different. You know,
right? Yeah, you know, I mean, I think and your listeners will know this, but we always have to remember that, yes, there are differences, but there are profound similarities. We have the genders have the same facial musculature. We have the same kinds of sensory receptors under the skin that help us understand touch. But in general, we know that women tend to be more empathetic. They, in our studies, show a little bit more compassion and gratitude, and I think that serves them well. Let me give you a finding I can't help but reporting on gender that I love, that speaks to this theme of women having a little more intelligence in the pro-social realm, if you will. We did this funny study of touch, and I love touch as a great medium of cooperation and the meaningful life. And we had participants try to communicate to a stranger who's sitting on the other side of a curtain a variety of different emotions to see if with the movements of our hand we can communicate things like gratitude or love or anger. And remarkably, people are very good at this. Touch is a very important medium of emotion or communication. But we got this great gender difference, which is we had all gender combinations, women trying to communicate to women and men, men trying to communicate to women and men. And when fitting with our theme, women were really good at communicating sympathy through touch, and men could not do it. And regrettably, there was another gender difference which may strike you, which is men were much better at communicating anger, and women had great difficulty communicating anger through touch. So
through touch, I mean, how would a man communicate anger through touch?
Just through a little tweak or a pinch of the skin, and that wasn't as intuitive for women.
And what about desire?
we didn't do that, but in a lot of our research, and this is the research of others, and it won't surprise your listeners, men read desire into all kinds of behaviors, smiles, pats on the back, little laughs and the like, and women are less likely to do that.
Men read desire?
Yes. They see desire in many different behaviors that women don't think are expressions of desire.
For example, well, you know, if we think about it, we think about how men developed over time, the idea was that women had to hide menses. I mean, they hid when they were ready for sex.
Right.
For the survival of the human race.
Right.
And so once they began hiding it, the man had to guess it.
Exactly.
So it's little wonder that the man's looking around all over the place saying, is that it? Is that it? Is that it? So he's sensitive to it. Women, on the other hand, they don't have to look for desire because it's always it.
Yeah,
on
excellent.
The other side, as they can see it, you know?
And you've just made, that's a terrific observation, you've made sense of a great literature where when women smile, men think there's an element of sexual desire there. When women pat them on the back, they interpret desire, and I think it's very fitting with your analysis.
Yeah. So are there any other gender differences that are really profound in your studies? You talked about, what about the sense of touch? What about mirror neurons? Have you looked at that at all?
We haven't looked at mirror neurons. They're tricky to study. These little neurons that fire in different parts of the brain that help you imitate other people's behavior. We know on the theme of mirroring and empathy and contagion, women are more empathic. Let me tell you about another gender difference that is in our research that will give your listeners a bit of pause. There is this amazing chemical called oxytocin that floats through your bloodstream. And it's one of the great stories in science in the past 15 years, and many people have heard about it. And oxytocin helps with uterine contractions, breastfeeding. When you get a nice massage, you get a little burst of oxytocin. When you eat chocolate, you get oxytocin. There are studies of conducted in Germany and Switzerland showing if you give people oxytocin with a little nasal spray, they become more devoted and generous and trusting. So in a way, it's like a trust chemical that builds connection and devotion. Our own research has shown that when people show this very loving smile that we've talked about, of a head tilt and open-handed gestures, they get this big surge of oxytocin. They're ready to be devoted. And when they show desire, they don't have this blast of oxytocin. And here's where gender rears its provocative head, which is women, estimates indicate, have 7 times the rate of oxytocin in their bloodstream. So that may enable them to be more trusting and devoted.
Which is why, if you send out an envelope advertising something and you include a little spray of oxytocin in that envelope within a year or so, people are going to buy the product. You know, I mean, it's like just because they've gotten it to a nasal spray.
I know.
Isn't it used to treat a certain disorders? It is. Yeah, autism is being treated, I think, with some kind of an oxytocin derivative.
Is that right?
Yeah, so that contact is made as opposed to contact is not made.
And that's why I think this new science of these positive emotions holds all kinds of promise for us in terms of treatment or, you know, God for making your workers more cooperative or what have you.
There's the good side. It does remind me a little of Brave New World, you know, where you're going to give somebody soma, and if you get somebody, I think it was soma in Brave New World, where you get the people to a point where everybody is walking around smiling and kind of at the mercy of anybody who's out there who's running the show.
Yeah, I agree.
So I know, I'm sure you must run into this with a great deal of people. The skeptics must say, hey, but don't you need to be on guard?
We do, of course. And part of the spirit of the book is just to countervail this tendency in our culture to think that evolution has produced only a selfish, violent, competitive being. And clearly, we're many things, and that's part of our story, but so too is the remarkable generosity that you see in humans and their caretaking abilities.
Do you think there are some people out there who have some reason or other? Do you think it's nature or nurture that leads to this basically good being?
Yeah. Well, that's really the $64 million question, you know, and we, you know, now that we're starting to chart where compassion is in the brain and this idea of oxytocin being a little chemical that helps promote trust or how touch promotes gratitude, the next question, and this is in a way the most important question, is what cultivates this? How do you turn those switches on in human beings? And I think we've learned some central notions in trying to answer that question. One, very intuitive, it's the wisdom of the ages, is the healthier the family bond and attachment, all of these emotions we've been talking about are a stronger part of a person's life if they have a strong attachment to caretakers. A finding I love that comes out of the study of altruism is hyper-altruists, people who really sacrifice for others. In this particular study, it was individuals who risked their lives to save Jews during the Holocaust. One of the first things they spoke of in their experiences of altruism is that it was part of their dinnertime conversation, that their grandparents talked about it and their parents talked about it. And I hope this new science of things like compassion reintroduces the concepts to our family conversations, our dinnertime conversations, So we're starting to learn.
Wait, back that up a little bit. How did the people who were the most courageous, who were hyper-altruists, report that they remember tales of hyper-altruism among their family?
Yeah, they just recall that their dinnertime conversations were often conversations about sacrifice or really generous acts or, you know, the Aesop's fable that talked about sacrifice, if there is one. And that they, really, the parents were cultivating a language and discourse of kindness.
And it's kind of interesting because from a parent's point of view, if you were to bring it out as a way of shaming a child,
right?
You know, like children in China are starving, so therefore you should eat your rice.
Right.
That's one thing, you know. But if you bring it as a matter of course,
yeah.
If you talk about it, if you point to it, if you look at the captain of the airplane that crashed in the river, and you
exactly.
talk a little bit about what decisions he may have made. But not as a way of telling the children that they're wrong to be selfish.
Yeah, exactly.
But just
yeah, that's a very important frame, isn't it?
Yeah, because usually most of the tales that children are told are lessons meant to correct them.
Yeah.
To teach them not to be selfish, you know?
Right.
And so then becomes this big question, which I think you approach, and I really would love you to talk about it. If there's one emotion to cultivate in children, it would be compassion.
Yeah. Yeah, and a vying for that place right behind is mirth or laughter. And laughter helps us deal with these darker complexities of life.
Like by mirth and laughter, you mean a sense of humor as well.
Yeah. But, you know, it's interesting, Armand, when we've done a lot of studies of compassion and how it's registered in little half-second tones of voice and touch, which we've talked about. We're doing some neuroscience of laughter and even some genetics, and their new genetic studies finding their particular genes that promote compassion-related physiology. But as I started to do this research, I always turn back in time and look at what the great traditions teach us, and Karen Armstrong, the wonderful historian of culture and religion, in a survey of the development of the world's ways of knowing, Judaic thought, Christian thought, Hindu, Buddhist thought, said the uniting idea is compassion. And when I looked at the evolution, the new evolutionary science of our species, this strange primate that we are, the same consensus emerges, which is that we have these very vulnerable offspring. We have people aging on later into life. There's a lot of caretaking that's required to hang in there as a species. And those two arguments said this is a core emotion to not only our design, but to leading a good life and being a healthy member of communities. And now we're doing this science showing what wonderful things compassion does for others, and what wonderful things it does for you.
You know, if we talk about our children,
yeah.
One of the places you'll always see with the child is around a hurt bird or a hurt
yeah.
animal. And most children will show some feeling about
yeah.
a hurt animal.
Yeah.
And most parents have some need to not have that child get so involved in that hurt
Very
animal, you know. And so what they'll say is, well, you know, put it back in the nest, it'll be okay, don't get concerned about it. Well, its mother left it alone, and that's what happens to little birds when mothers
yeah.
get angry at them and leave them alone. They do something with it
yep.
that takes that precious moment
yeah.
that could be nurtured not into a giant heartache, but into some love of the child
yeah.
for feeling this compassion, some way of reflecting to the child that this is a wonderful feeling that you have here.
Yeah. My boy, what an illuminating comment. And, you know, first of all, you know, as I started to study compassion, I was struck, just as you say, Armand, about how compassionate children are. Here's one example. Little babies will cry at the crying of another baby, but not their own crying. So they're crying in response to the suffering of others. They show kind behaviors starting very early in life. And I resonate with your observation so much that as parents, we turn away from those moments of suffering where your child is appreciating suffering, and we need to really cultivate that experience, that really is a great vitamin or pathway to ethical understanding.
What do you consider your next step in your research?
I'm fortunate to have such terrific students here and such a great university at Berkeley. But one is we are just starting to chart the compassionate regions of the nervous system in the brain. We're studying a region of the nervous system called the vagus nerve,
yes,
which is not named after Las Vegas, but it's Latin for wandering. Starts in your brainstem, wanders through your lungs and your heart, down to your digestive organs. And we now have 3 or 4 studies showing, oh, by the way, it's intertwined with oxytocin receptors. We think it's unique to mammals. It gives you that feeling a lot of people may have felt today at the inauguration of tearing and warming up in the chest. And our studies are starting to show, 3 or 4 different studies, that it's part of feeling compassion and common humanity. It links up to parts of the frontal lobes that are involved in compassion. So we really want to map that system, because once you know that, where compassion is in the nervous system, we can then relate it to physical longevity, the health of a marriage. What kind of kids? We study these what we call vagal superstars, who are people who have really active vagus nerves, and we're starting to find they have more friends. They break up fights on school playgrounds. So that is front and center in our lab.
I think in some research I read as well, there was the absence of vagal activity in people with Alzheimer's. Do you know about that connection?
I don't know that one, but
it certainly makes sense, doesn't it?
Yep, it sure does. And we're starting to look at other clinical disorders like certain episodes of depression, and people are starting to look at certain kinds of autism and its relation to the vagus nerve. So to me, that's so exciting, and it points to new kinds of therapies and a different way to understand the roots of compassion.
The group of people you're working with, you've been with them for how long?
Well, I mainly work with my graduate students, about 10 of them, and if all goes well, they go on to become professors, and many of them are, and then I have postdoctoral fellows as well, so it's a big lab.
And the school is such a fabulous school to be doing research. I mean, it's one of the few places that really welcome you with a smile, don't they?
They do, and not only that, but they're kind of proud that they have a professor who studies compassion or Buddhism or awe and, you know, touch. I can get away with it here.
How did you get to work with them?
Well, I have taken a traditional academic path, and after my PhD was a professor at Madison, Wisconsin, and now at Berkeley. And both of those universities, it's interesting. They were long interested in emotion, which is the thing I study most, which is a relatively recent arrival in our science. So they saw me as a risky but appropriate person to bring to their faculty.
Well, my guest is Dr. Keltner, the name of the book. And we will be back with you again, my friends. It's a wonderful, wonderful interview. I want to thank you so much for being with us. We will be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m. And thank you so much for being here. If you want to get a copy of today's show, you can go to the WBAI.org and listen in. Send me an email, armand@thepositivemind.com. Bye-bye for now, my friends.